Matthew 5, verses 38 through 42. The 24th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on July 3, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So we're continuing in the book of Matthew. We're in the Sermon on the Mount. We're in that section of the sermon that is sometimes called the antitheses, the "you have heard it said, but I say to you" section. We're in Matthew chapter 5. We'll be looking, starting at verse 38 today. My argument has been, as we've been going along, that Jesus does not intend to disagree with or critique the Old Testament passages that he quotes. Instead, he is talking about how the Pharisees use the Old Testament. He started this section by saying that our righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees, and now I understand him to be giving examples of what he's talking about. So each time he says, "you have heard that it was said," and then he quotes something from the Old Testament, and then he follows it with, "but I say to you," as I say, I don't think he means to contradict the passage that he's quoting. Instead, he is saying something like this: "You have heard the Pharisees, when they try to justify themselves as righteous men, quote this passage, but I say to you that they are misusing it. They have distorted some more fundamentally important teaching of the Old Testament." So that's what I think he's been doing throughout this section, and we're going to see that same pattern once again, starting in Matthew 5, 38. "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." Okay, so let's just admit up front that this is a tough passage to listen to. I find it so. As been true for all of the passages in this section, Jesus starts out by referring to something from the Old Testament. Here he says, "you have heard it that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." So our first task, as it has been each week, is to look at the Old Testament background to the section that Jesus is quoting. The first Old Testament passage that refers to an eye for an eye is Exodus 21, starting with 22. There are three passages that use this phrase. The first one is in Exodus 21, 22. "If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." There's some debate about exactly what this law is specifying. Is it talking about injury to the woman or to the baby or both? Some of the rabbis argued that it was only injuries to the mother that were in view, and as an interesting sidelight, they argued from this interpretation of the passage for the morality of abortion. Since an eye for an eye was only being applied to the mother in this case, as they understood it, and not to the baby, that meant that the premature fetus was not considered fully human. But many others argued, and still argue, that injury to either the baby or the mother is in view. At any rate, whatever the specifics of the law are intended to communicate, somebody has been damaged, someone has been harmed, and this passage is giving instructions on how judges should penalize these harms that have been caused. The idea is that of strict but proportional justice. Whatever damage you have caused will be inflicted upon you. The second passage that uses this terminology is in Leviticus 24:17. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am Yahweh your God. So, again, instructions for how the judges are to pronounce judgment. If you kill someone else's animals, you have to make it good. I assume you have to replace the animal with a new living one. But anything that you do to harm a human being is going to be done to you. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, and ultimately life for life. If you kill, then you will be killed. And this does not just apply to your fellow Israelites. If you harm a stranger, a non-Israelite, the punishment for you will be the same. Okay, and then the third passage that uses this kind of language is in Deuteronomy 19, start with verse 16. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. And the judges shall investigate thoroughly. And if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you, and the rest will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Okay, so as you can tell, this law deals with the intention to do harm. For example, I might falsely testify that my neighbor committed murder. If my testimony were to prevail, then he's going to be killed, he's going to be executed as a murderer. But it is discovered that I am lying. I'm trying to get him executed by lying about him having done this thing. I testified falsely so that he would be executed, therefore I myself will be executed instead. I lied to bring about his death, so instead I have brought about my own death. Whatever harm I tried to inflict on him by testifying falsely in court, that harm will be inflicted on me. So you're probably aware that in our own modern society, people often debate about the nature and purpose of criminal justice. When people commit crimes, we put them in jail, we make them pay fines, perhaps we execute them. But why do we do these things? There are several reasons why we might inflict civil penalties on a lawbreaker. You hear people talking about this sort of thing all the time. One reason we punish lawbreakers is to discourage them from committing the crime again. And of course, with capital punishment, if we execute them, we guarantee that they will not commit the crime again. Another reason might be to discourage others from committing the same crime. People see that crime is severely punished, and so they regulate their behavior in order to avoid getting the punishment. We also talk about the idea of justice. It is right and appropriate for lawbreakers to pay for their crimes, and there is something healthy about a society that does what is right and appropriate in response to evil doing. Well, you might have noticed that this passage talks a bit about the reasons for the punishment it prescribes. If a person testifies falsely in an attempt to harm another person, those harms will be inflicted on the liar instead. Why? Deuteronomy 19:19, "Then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you, and the rest will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such an evil thing among you." Part of the reasoning in this passage is easy to understand. It is the same thinking that people use today. This law is a disincentive to commit the crime of testifying falsely against someone. People risk serious injury or death if they testify falsely against someone. And so people are inclined to clean up their act. And that's what it says. So this law serves to promote good civil behavior. Part of the rationale is we will have less of this sort of thing if we deal with it strictly. But the rest of the reasoning is a little trickier. It says, "You shall purge the evil from among you." We could interpret this as also being about promoting good civil behavior. That is, if someone tried to bring about someone else's death by testifying falsely, then the judges would execute him and remove his evil behavior from society. His particular evil behavior is not going to happen because he's gone. He's dead. He's not going to do that again. Even if the punishment is losing an eye or a hand, it is dealing with his evil and making it less likely that he will commit that act again. So that would be one way to understand the idea of purging the evil from among you. It is the idea of reducing evil behavior. Let's eliminate the source of evil behavior so we have less of it. Perhaps that's part of what it's getting at. But I think we can't forget that Israel was a true theocracy. That is, it was a nation ruled directly by God. Their laws were not just practical ways of promoting civil order. They served a lot of purposes. They also served, for example, to promote religious purity in the nation. Just as a man might have to ritually wash his hands to cleanse himself religiously, so the nation might have to do the same sort of thing. Not just for social reasons, not just to promote civil order, but for religious reasons, the evil must be purged from among them. The intent was not just to promote good behavior, but perhaps it was to send a message that God was serious about the difference between good and evil. To remain pure as a nation before God, the nation must deal with the evil in their midst. They must purge it. Okay, so perhaps. I think that's not unlikely as to part of the rationale for that law. Okay, so we've looked at these three places where we've seen an eye for an eye and so forth. What have we learned? The three places it is used are all concerning judicial pronouncements. When one person harms another one, the judges, those who enforce the law, step in and prescribe certain punishments. Those punishments are strict but proportional. Exactly the harm you caused or tried to cause, that is the harm that will be done to you. These laws promoted civil order and religious purity. The phrase "an eye for an eye" is not intended to be a guide to personal behavior. Just like our laws today for what the state can do are not a guide to what I personally can do. A person can get years in jail for breaking and entering, but if someone breaks into my home, I don't have the right to grab them and lock them behind bars in my basement. The state has the right to do that, but I don't have the right to do that. Likewise, the Old Testament law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is not saying, if a guy knocks out your tooth, then go and knock out his tooth. This is not permission for certain kinds of personal behavior. The law is giving sentencing guidelines to civil judges as they enforce the law in society. Now, right away, this gives us something to think about regarding Jesus' teaching in Matthew. because clearly Jesus is concerned with personal behavior in his teaching in this section. What do I do when someone sues me for my shirt? What do I do when someone wants to borrow money from me? As I have been arguing, Jesus is not disagreeing with the Old Testament law, and in fact, in this case, it's fairly easy to see that he's not really talking about that civil law at all. He is not at all suggesting that judges in Israel should not punish criminal lawbreakers. He's not speaking to that sort of issue at all. Evidently, though, Jesus sees the Pharisees as somehow using the law's requirement of an eye for an eye as some sort of justification for their own personal behavior. In some ways, the Pharisees are misusing these legal instructions given to the judges of Israel. In some way, they are justifying the way they individually treat people by appealing to the law that says an eye for an eye. Now, I think it's important that we not be simplistic here, or maybe I should just say, I don't want to miscommunicate. Is Jesus saying that the Pharisees didn't understand the difference between what a judge can do and what a private individual can do? I don't think so. I don't think that is what he's charging them with. I think the Pharisees clearly would have understood that an eye for an eye comes from instructions that are given to a judge about how to handle civil infractions. There is no reason to think that they went around poking people in the eye, knocking out other people's teeth, and then saying, the law says I can do that. I don't think that was the problem that Jesus is speaking to. I don't know if this is relevant to that question, but I keep reading that it is likely that Israel had stopped applying this an eye for an eye literally in its laws anyway. The evidence seems to suggest they had shifted to monetary fines. So the more seriously you damaged someone, the more you had to pay. But at any rate, whether that's relevant or not, I think that Jesus is not saying to the Pharisees, you have mistakenly taken a judge's right to inflict retribution and turned it into your personal right to inflict retribution. I don't think that's exactly the problem. I think what the Pharisees are doing is subtler than that. And I think Jesus' critique is subtler than that. So instead, let me give you an example that illustrates the sort of thing that I think Jesus is getting at. Imagine that I have a big apple tree on my property. The laws of my society protect me from theft. It is against the law to come on my property and take my apples from my tree. Let's suppose. Maybe it isn't anymore, I don't know, but let's just imagine that in fact it is against the law. Okay, so the law protects me from having my apples stolen, and the law promotes justice by insisting that those who steal my apples pay the penalty. Now, let's further imagine that my neighbor has a habit of coming over and picking apples off of my tree. The question is, what am I going to do about it? Can you see that I might very well decide to do nothing about it? I might just choose to generously forgive my neighbor and let him pick the apples. There might be something really wrong with me if I were to say, you know, there's a law against that. I have a right to have my neighbor not come and pick my apples. I'm going to go to the police and say, that guy is breaking the law. You need to lock him up because he keeps taking my apples. The law does offer me protection. The law offers me justice. But maybe there are times when I shouldn't want protection and justice. Maybe there are times when mercy is more important than justice. We know that there is always a delicate balance between justice and mercy. And I, as an individual, have a freedom to be merciful that the civil law does not. If you steal my property, it would be wrong for the law to do nothing about it. The judge shouldn't say, you robbed him blind, but I forgive you. That's not the sort of thing that a judge should do. It is the judge's job to protect me. It is the judge's job to give me justice. A society is evil if it does not protect its people and enforce justice. But there is nothing that says that I have to avail myself of this protection and justice. There is nothing stopping me from forgiving you for stealing my stuff. And in fact, maybe that is what I ought to do. A society cannot be good if it fails to enforce justice. But sometimes a man cannot be good if he insists on enforcing justice. It is this important truth, I believe, that the Pharisees were downplaying. The law says an eye for an eye. This is a way of protecting the innocent and promoting justice. If you hurt me, the law says that justice demands that you pay. And so the Pharisees can appeal to this same principle. The law insists on justice. Therefore, we can be righteous men if we insist on justice. Now, we won't necessarily take justice into our own hands. I may not poke out your eye or knock your tooth out, but we can drag you to court and let the judge punish you. But we will certainly turn you over to the judge. We will insist on getting every bit of justice and retribution we have legally coming to us. And we will call ourselves righteous men while we are doing it, because that's what the law allows. This is what Jesus is calling into question, as I understand it. The fact is that at times, being a righteous man requires not demanding justice. The big question in this section, however, is this: why would we not seek retribution? Why would we not defend ourselves and seek justice? What principle is Jesus asking us to live by here? So what I want to do is look at the examples he gives, the very shocking sort of examples that he gives here, and then come back to this question. What is his rationale? What is it that he wants from us here? Because what he's saying is quite astounding, and it's legitimate to ask the question, does he really mean this? Is this really what he wants me to do? So this is what we're going to try to sort out at the end. But let's try to look at his examples first of all, and I'll explain a few things to you, and then we'll come back to this big question. He starts his comments in verse 39, "But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil." I take this as an overall comment about the examples he is about to give. The evil he is talking about is when people unjustly harm us. Remember, these are his comments on how the Pharisees use an eye for an eye. That law is about a just and appropriate retaliation when someone harms someone else. Someone has harmed you, and the law responds with an appropriate punishment. So, him who is evil is the one who has dealt with you unjustly in some way. Jesus tells us not to resist this unjust person. The law, with its an eye for an eye, gives the injured party a right to legal retribution. I have been harmed, and I can ask the law for justice. I am resisting the evil person by insisting that their unjust actions stop and that they pay for their offense. In fact, this word, translated resist, is sometimes used in legal contexts. To resist someone can mean to take them to court to make them stop doing the thing that they're doing. So I think Jesus is saying something like this. When someone treats you unjustly, the natural response would be to make them stop and make them pay. You might do this through personal retaliation, or you might do it by appealing to the courts, but I'm saying, don't do it. Okay, so we gulp on that one and come to his first example. Continues on in verse 39. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. There may be significance to the fact that Jesus specifies the right cheek. Many people comment on this. Since most people are right-handed, it could be that we are to picture a backhanded slap. For me to hit somebody on the right cheek with my right hand would involve going like that. The rabbis said that a backhanded slap was doubly insulting and fined you double the amount of money if you did it. So if I hit you like this, I get fined. If I hit you like that, I get double the fine, because it is even more insulting, the way the rabbis looked at it. Or else, we could picture, perhaps, if I've hit you on the right cheek, maybe I've used my left hand, which can be insulting also because the left hand was considered to be unclean. So either way, Jesus may be implying a particularly insulting sort of slap in this case. So how are you going to respond? Do you hit him back? Do you take him to court and make him pay an eye for an eye, make him pay a fine or whatever it might be? No, you make a very dramatic gesture of non-retaliation. You turn the other cheek to him. Okay, we'll come back and look at this stuff more, but let's look at the next example in verse 40. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. The coat that Jesus refers to is the outer garment that a person would wear. That garment is actually referred to in the law. For example, in Exodus 22:25, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak, and this is this outer garment that it's talking about, as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets, for that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it will come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. So you have various situations where there's collateral, right? If you loan something and you take something from the person that you're loaning the money to, but you can't keep their outer garment for longer than a day. You have to give it back to them that very day because they need it. If this is a poor person, this may be their only covering at night. So you can't keep their outer garment. So there are other places, at least one other place, that talk about this same thing. So the interesting thing is that you are legally entitled to keep the outer garment that Jesus is talking about. So Jesus is imagining a situation where someone sues you for your shirt, for the inner garment. Well, the law would theoretically allow that. There's nothing illegal about doing such a thing. But the law wouldn't allow you to take the outer garment from someone. So now, here's the situation. This person is trying to do you harm by taking your shirt. Instead of fighting him in court, Jesus is saying, give him your outer garment as well, which I think most people understand, and I think it makes sense, that he's saying, give him what he couldn't even get from you if he did take you to court. You're giving him more than he would be entitled to. The court wouldn't have given him your outer garment, but you're giving it to him. The next example is in verse 41, and whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Jesus is probably referring to the way Roman soldiers would grab people and make them carry their equipment for a certain distance. An example is when Jesus was carrying his cross to Golgotha, he fell and he couldn't carry it anymore. So a Roman soldier grabbed a bystander, Simon of Cyrene, and forced him to carry the cross the rest of the way. Soldiers could do this. The practice, as I understand it, was that the soldiers were allowed to require a certain distance from you. They couldn't ask you to do it indefinitely, but there might be a limit, like, say, a mile. In this case, when he says you're forced to go a mile, it might be that that's the limit that the soldier could ask you to go. Then he had to let you go so you could go back home, and he'd grab somebody else and make them take it another mile. Now, this statement can't help having a little political resonance in the climate that Jesus is talking about. The Jewish zealots were those who opposed the Roman occupation of Judea. They advocated resisting Rome as much as possible. So a zealot would certainly do everything it was possible to do to resist a soldier who forced him, a Roman soldier, an occupying soldier who forced him to go a mile with him to carry his stuff. Jesus is saying, rather than resist him, go farther than he asked you to go. And the last example is in verse 42, give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. This one seems a little different at first. No one is hitting you or suing you or grabbing you and making you do something. You're being asked for money. Remember, this is still in the context of Jesus' comments about an eye for an eye. We're still talking about a context in which there is somebody who in some way is imposing on you or doing you some harm. So I think that Jesus is implying that the other person in this case is imposing on you in some way. Jesus doesn't have to tell us to help our children if they are in trouble and need financial help. But it's more likely that he's speaking to the sort of situation where I know that the other person does not have my best interests at heart. They just want my money. Even though they are not really entitled to it, I have no obligation to give them this money. They have no right to it. And I'm not sure that I'm going to come out of this situation very well. Again, the principle is do not resist the one who is doing you harm. The parallel version in Luke 6:30 says, "Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back." The situation seems to involve the potential of theft, or at least loss. The person has no right to my stuff, and they may end up taking it without repaying. And yet, we are being told not to resist them, but to grant their request. This is getting more and more uncomfortable as we go along here. What in the world is Jesus talking about here? So, having looked at his examples, now we want to try to sort this all out. What is he talking about? What does he want from us? And that may seem a strange question. It may seem obvious what he wants from us. Turn another cheek, give him your outer garment, go 2 miles, and give people who want to borrow money from you. But what we're trying to do is figure out what is it that he's got in mind here? What is it that he's saying is wrong with the way the Pharisees are going about this, and how does he want us to go about it? So I have a few observations. This is my attempt to make some sense out of what's going on here. First of all, I think a very obvious and important starting point is one of the most important commands in the Old Testament, Leviticus 19:18. I'll start reading in 19:17. "You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Jesus calls this one of the two greatest commandments in the Old Testament. And interestingly, there's an account in the Gospels where Jesus is talking to a scribe who agrees with him, who says, yes, that's exactly right. That love your neighbor as yourself is one of the two great commandments, the other being to love God. So the two great commandments of the Old Testament are to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Those commandments underlie and inform everything else that is in the law. So yes, it is true that there is a civil law that requires an eye for an eye. There is a principle of civil justice at work here. Innocent people should be protected. Criminal harms should be punished. But as we try to understand the implication of that law for ourselves, the overarching principle we must deal with is from Leviticus. Love your neighbor as yourself. Sometimes my neighbor will do me wrong, but according to the law in Leviticus, I am not to seek vengeance. I am not to bear a grudge. Instead, I am to treat my neighbor as I myself would want to be treated. So I'm not really allowed to say, as the Pharisees had said, look, the law allows for retribution. So I can call for retribution against those who have wronged me, and I will be a righteous man, because that's what the law allows. The reason that I can't go in that direction is because one of the great commandments calls me to seek the good of my neighbor, even when he has wronged me. I would argue that Leviticus 19:18 is a key to understanding Jesus' point concerning an eye for an eye. In fact, it's a key to understanding a lot of the points that he makes in the Sermon on the Mount. I am to seek my neighbor's good the way I would think about my own good. Next, as we try to put this together, I think what Jesus said in the Beatitudes is very relevant here, very much related. In particular, I'm thinking of Matthew 5:9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." As I understand what it means to be a peacemaker is to stop the cycle of aggression. So Tom does something to Bill, and so Bill then, feeling justified, rightly resists and opposes Tom for having done that. Now Tom responds back to the resistance that Bill showed, and on it goes. That's what's striking about each of the examples that Jesus gives here. It seems to me that he's giving a very striking and attention-grabbing examples of peacemaking. In each case, Jesus is proposing a striking refusal to escalate the conflict. So Tom gives a backhanded slap to Bill. Considering strictly the issue of justice, Bill could resist. He could hit him back. He could take him to court. He could refuse to talk to him ever again. But instead, Bill gives a dramatic gesture of not responding in kind. By turning the other cheek, it's a way of saying, I am not going to respond to this the way you expect. I am not going to retaliate for what you have done. Or Tom wrongfully sues Bill for his shirt. Bill could fight him for it, and so Tom and Bill could become adversaries for life. Instead, Bill gives Tom the shirt, and as Jesus pictures it, he goes further, giving him his outer garment that the law would never have given to Tom. Bill had the right to keep that outer garment, no matter how the lawsuit had gone. Again, this is this dramatic gesture of, not only am I not going to act in anger toward you for suing me for my shirt, but I'm going to give you more. It's as if I am actually thinking about you. I know that you are seeking my harm here, but I'm thinking about you. So, and I want to show that by giving you my outer garment as well. Again, this is a dramatic gesture of a refusal to retaliate. Or Tom could be a Roman soldier, forcibly grabbing Bill and making him carry his equipment. If Bill were a Jewish zealot, he would never stand for this. The Roman oppressors are forcing their will on us. I have to fight back. But instead, Bill stops the cycle of aggression by willingly carrying the equipment, and then he makes the dramatic gesture of going farther than he had to. The first mile, Tom the soldier can be thinking, Bill is doing this because I made him do it. But the second mile, Bill is communicating, I am not holding what you did against you. Now I am carrying your equipment for your sake, because I have you in mind. I am seeking good things for you, even though you compelled me to do this thing. Or Tom could be the kind of taker that hits Bill up for money and is unlikely to pay it back. Tom understands that he's created a certain tension between himself and Bill, but he doesn't care. He just wants the money. Bill could, with a certain amount of justice, say, no, if I loan you money, I'll never get it back. No way. Instead, Bill dissolves the tension between Tom and himself and treats Tom better than he deserves. Bill gives Tom the money. In each case, Jesus has proposed a dramatic reversal. In the normal course of things, we want justice for ourselves. But Jesus is proposing that we think about the other guy, even when the other guy has sought our harm. We are to seek his good. We are to strive to promote peace between us. And so we have these dramatic examples of goodwill and non-retaliation. We are to judge our actions, I would say, by these standards. Am I seeking the good of my neighbor? Am I seeking to promote reconciliation and peace between us? Now, there's something more I need to say about that, though, because I know that there are many people who would insist that I have not gone far enough in what I've said here. Jesus is not just using the positive incentive that we are to love our neighbor and seek peace. Jesus is telling us, according to this way of thinking, that it is always wrong, in principle, to aggressively resist another person. This is the kind of example that people always give, and I know, but I'm going to give it anyway because it helps us to see clearly, maybe by an extreme example, the sort of thing we're talking about. If someone jumps out of a bush and tries to kill me with a knife, by this way of thinking, it would be wrong for me to fight him or hit him or resist him in any way, because it is always wrong in principle to act against another person, whether they are acting against you or not. Some people see Jesus advocating this kind of radical pacifism here. Many people see it here. No matter what the other person is doing, it is wrong to resist them, especially if it involves violence of any kind. And I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Many people have understood Jesus to be saying that in this section. This way of thinking is dependent on looking at the way Jesus is using language here in a certain way. They're seeing Jesus as literally laying down specific rules for us that must be followed in all circumstances. In any and all situations in which someone strikes you on the right cheek, you must turn the other cheek. That is, you must not resist, but that turn the other cheek is being interpreted as saying you must let them continue to do as much violence to you as they wish. This rule then is extended to every similar situation. Whatever violence someone wants to do to you, the only righteous response is to let them keep doing it. That is the only thing that a good person could do. It would be morally wrong for you to strike back, even if it is to prevent the person from doing serious harm. That is the rule that Jesus gives us. Now, I hope I'm being clear. This is not how I understand what Jesus is saying here, but this is a common way of understanding what he's saying. Part of the reason I don't go this way, I have already made clear. I see Jesus as appealing to the underlying principle in the Old Testament that I should seek the good of my neighbor and seek to promote reconciliation for my neighbor's sake. I am not to take vengeance, but I am to love my neighbor as myself. That is the principle that Jesus is appealing to here. He is not giving a rule, submit to whatever violence anyone wants to commit. Instead, he is telling us that we have to think about more than just getting justice when we are dealing with other people. Righteousness demands that we consider our neighbor's good when we decide how to respond. That means using judgment to determine what the loving thing to do is in any particular situation. Another reason I don't think that Jesus is teaching that sort of radical pacifism is the nature of the way he teaches. Jesus uses strong black and white statements to make his points. He uses hyperbole. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. I don't think that the church has been wrong in the fact that, by and large, Christians have not been plucking out their eyes and cutting off their hands through history, because that's not what Jesus was getting at. There's something very important that he's getting at, but it wasn't that. So Jesus makes these strong sorts of statements and then demands of us that we understand them in the light of the full biblical teaching. And that's what I think is happening here. Turn the other cheek is not a rule. Turn the other cheek is a deliberately provocative example of what it might look like to seek peace for the sake of my neighbor's good. Does turning the other cheek always promote my neighbor's good? No. To take the obvious extreme example I gave a minute ago, if someone jumps out of a bush and tries to kill me with a knife, is it loving for me to let that person do it? Is that how I should think about my actions there? Am I a peacemaker if I let a serial killer kill as many people as he wants? Obviously, I'm picking very extreme examples, but I pick them to make what I hope is a good and rational point. If Jesus really is laying down a rule, always let people commit as much violence as they want because it is always wrong to act against them to make them stop, then I should let the attacker kill me. But if Jesus is giving a striking example of what peacemaking might look like, what loving my neighbor might look like, then I have to use my judgment to figure out the best choice in any particular situation. I am not trying to escape the force of what Jesus is saying here. This is demanding, however you look at it. But let's remind ourselves what Jesus is trying to do. The Pharisees defend their own righteousness by appealing to the law. In this case, they appeal to the law that says an eye for an eye. They rightly recognize that there is a principle of justice in the law. The law rightly calls for a strict but proportional punishment for harming others. But what the Pharisees then conclude from this law is that retribution is legal. They can legally pursue retribution and still be righteous men. The law allows them to seek justice against those who wrong them, and so they can be as vindictive as they want and be legal and righteous while they are doing it. But what the Pharisees have forgotten is the overriding principle of the law. We are not to seek vengeance. We are not to hold grudges. Instead, in spite of our neighbors having wronged us, we are still to seek what is good for them, even as we wish good for ourselves. And so Jesus gives us these striking examples of ways that we can seek the good of those who wrong us. We stop the cycle of aggression. We boldly demonstrate our willingness to be at peace with those who wrong us for their sake, when that is the appropriate and good thing for them. That is the kind of righteousness the law is ultimately promoting. So, once again, as we have seen in previous weeks, we respond to this call from God in two ways. We seek to live in a way that promotes this thing that God is calling us to. That is, we seek the good of our neighbor. We seek to be reconciled to those who have sought our harm. So we see this as the way that we should try to follow. And most importantly, we submit to this truth and confess when we fail to live that way. This is the way it has been with all of the examples that we've seen that Jesus has spelled out here. This righteousness that is greater than the Pharisees, it gives us a model for what we should be pursuing, and it tells us how we should think about ourselves in relationship to God. The Pharisees had set an absurdly low standard of righteousness. Hey, the law has a place for justice and retribution, so I can demand all the justice and retribution I want and still be a righteous man. But Jesus is telling us that we are not to live that way. The high call of God is to love sacrificially. And this call to love is a high and difficult call. In this world, it is always costly to love. But that is what we are called to do. To seek the good of others, even the good of those who have tried to harm us. We are being called by Jesus to follow that way, to see that as our call, as the way that we ought to live. And we are being asked by Jesus to confess before God the reality that we fail to live up to it. So there are some thoughts on that one. Very tricky passage. And any comments or questions you might have, this would be a good time for them.
Thanks, Ron. I thought that was really helpful in understanding, trying to understand what Jesus is saying here. I just have a thought about kind of the Pharisees, sort of the psychology of their approach to the law that I'd like to hear your thoughts on. I'm trying to pinpoint exactly what it is where they've gone wrong. And it seems like there's kind of this reductionist approach to morality that they've employed. And I say reductionist because they're reducing what it means to be good to just doing things that we've decided are good. So God has made this law, and to do the things in this law is good. So if we do those, then we're good. Like, I'm part of this group that God appeared to, the Jews. We do things a certain way. We worship at certain times and places. We're following what God has said. If I'm doing that, I'm in and I'm good. And if I make a mistake, then I'm out for a minute and I make sacrifices and I'm in again. So I'm good. And I think what Jesus is saying seems to be like, you're using that as a cover to like hide from the fact that you really aren't good. you really, there's more to it than that. There's a fundamental problem that the law isn't really fixing. It's more showing you that the problem is there, if you understand it right. Do you think that that's kind of at the heart of what his critique of that?
Yes, I think so. I have argued, the very last thing you said there, I do think that Jesus is not saying anything, and I know I'm in the minority in saying this. I notice as I've been reading around that very few people agree with me about this. But I don't think that Jesus is saying anything different than what the law was at least implying. I don't think that in any way he's coming along and saying, here's where it fell short, let me fix it for you. What he is doing is finding bold and provocative ways of spelling out the implications of the fundamental teaching of the law, I think. So, yeah, but I agree with you. It kind of seems to me like this example is similar to the one about divorce. We have a law where Moses allowed for divorce, and so I can avail myself of that and be a righteous man, even while I have missed the point about what God intended marriage to be. Likewise, we have these civil instructions about retribution in justice, and so I look at that and say, okay, see, this law allows for this retribution in justice, so I can be involved in that and be a righteous man. But again, I have lost out on the big picture of how God actually wants me to relate to God and my neighbor as I'm confronting these issues, especially as it's spelled out in Leviticus. So yeah, hiding, I think, covering the bigger problem by appealing to specific rules that I can look at and say, see, that leaves this room for this, so that means I'm not in violation. But all the while having missed the point that that's not what that was intended to do. The law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth has a place in the concept of justice in the civil society of Israel under the rule of God and his religious rules, but it is not intended to be a lone and reliable guide to how I, as an individual, am supposed to relate to other individuals. That's a different thing. So I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I think so. And it seems like Jesus is saying that the purpose of the law is to show them what it means to be good. Like, what God is asking through the law is that people actually be good, not just do these things that are good, and that it is so easy to confuse those and make them the same thing. I'm doing what's good, so I am good, yeah. Right? But he is consistently, it seems like, pushing to remove that cover, take away those shields that we all, I guess, make for ourselves, and saying, no, God is asking you through this to be good, and you should embrace that.
Yeah, and as I say, I think that has two parts. It had two parts in the law. It has two parts in the teaching of Jesus. It has two parts in the gospel as is proclaimed by Paul, and that is the law and the gospel and all of the teaching of Jesus, and all of it is pointing out two things to me. First of all, if I'm following God, that's the direction he's going. That's what God wants from us, is the love of my neighbor as myself, the love of God and those things. And it shows me then clearly, it gives me a very clear picture of myself and shows me why I need the mercy of God and what I need his mercy for, because I understand so clearly what he has called us to as human beings and how we fall short of that. But both of those things are true. There's a long history of debate about this sort of thing in Reformed circles, debates about the purposes of the law. Is the law merely to show me my inadequacy and how I need mercy? Or does it serve as some sort of guide to my conduct as well? And I'm very much on the side that it does both of those things, that it does show me where I fall short, but it also shows me what I am being called to. And so, yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ron. That was really clear. I appreciated it. I have an idea that I'm wanting to present and ask you to interact with. So in your assessment of what Jesus is saying here, you focused a lot on the interpersonal side of things. You used words like peacekeeping and reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is if perhaps it is we should think of it as more of an intrapersonal issue, in the sense that, is it possible that this is more about Jesus telling us what kind of person we should be, that is, a person who's willing to forgive? And the reason why I'm wondering about that is, if we take the example you gave with the neighbor and your apple tree, I can imagine a situation where my neighbor's taking my apples, and in the interest of keeping the peace, I go ahead and let him. Or maybe I even take over a box and say, mm-hmm. here's some apples. Mm-hmm. But inside, I am bitter and resentful towards my neighbor.
Right.
So I'm wondering, so that's where the intrapersonal issue, and then also your example of the way the pacifists take this passage, mm-hmm. and your example of the guy who jumps out and is mm-hmm. trying to kill you. If we focus more on the, I need to be a forgiving person, rather than the, I need to just let mm-hmm. people do what they want to do to keep the peace, then that sort of solves that issue as well, in the sense that, no, I can fight for my life and yet turn around and forgive that person for
right.
doing what they did.
Right.
So could you talk about
that? Well, yeah, I agree. He's not replacing, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about this, he's not replacing a low set of behaviors with a higher, harder set of behaviors that we must meet. The issue isn't so much how successfully have I accomplished these behaviors. Remember, the issue that he's addressing is the Pharisees thinking that they could describe themselves as righteous men because the law gives them this model of, look, there is this room for retribution as I'm dealing with people who have harmed me in some way. So the issue is my willingness to see the truth of things. So that's partly why I'm put in the part about seeing myself in the light of what this demands, recognizing that I fall short of it, and that can include not just my behaviors, but my awareness of my attitudes in the midst of all of that. What Jesus is really calling us to, I think this is just another way of spelling out the sorts of things he's talking about in the Beatitudes, of hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being poor in spirit, and all of those things where inside, really, the person that I am dealing with what this is really about. So yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. If I sounded like I was saying something different, that was not as clear as you said, because I don't at all want to say Jesus is coming along and giving harder rules for behavior than we had before. It obviously has to do with my behavior, because ultimately the things that I choose to believe are going to have an end, and the truths that I accept are going to have an impact on the way I do things. But the real issue is whether I am willing to submit to the very big picture of what God's will is for human life, instead of setting the bar really low and then saying, look, I got over it. But yeah, no, I totally agree with what you're saying.
I think what I've been at was the same thing that Catherine was. It's a hard attitude versus a non-hard attitude. Mm-hmm. And so often when we react to things, it's hard to tell which one is, for me anyway, which one is in charge. Mm-hmm. So when Christians say that they're such loving people, so often it's like, well, I can embrace this person irregardless of their lifestyle or whatever, wrap my arms around them, and I'm such a loving person and can relate to them and da-da-da-da-da. But it's an entirely different, entirely different issue when an injustice has been done, mm-hmm. and then you are to be a loving person. Right. And there was just a classic example yesterday of this, and for myself, and it's out at our farm, there's a neighbor that has cows and no fence. And so when that happens, they've come down and destroyed the lawn. And so, and I've fought this forever. So all this stuff goes through my head, and I've chosen to handle it a certain way that benefits me, I think, in the long run.
Right.
Rather than looking at how I should relate to it as, or deal with it from a perspective, or what God would want me to do or to feel about it with regards to this particular neighbor. And yesterday, a guy stopped by and wanted to buy some hay from me. And so I went up to his place, and he showed me his place. He had just bought it, and he bought it from the previous owners, who was as is. And on this place, evidently, there was a pile of pipe. And one day he came up to his place, and the pipe was gone. Well, this previous owner had agreed to another neighbor that he could take the pipe. And so after this guy bought it, he took the pipe. Well, this guy, in talking to him, he says, you know, I bought this place. My wife's not interested in it. My kid's not interested in it. My grandkids aren't interested in it. I just like it. He says, I think I'll leave it to the church. And so in talking to him, you know, he was a Christian and everything. But he says, you know, he says, I'm suing that guy. And so in my head, I'm thinking, you're going to go hire a lawyer to try to reach, and I don't know what the pipe is worth or whatever, that go through the hassle and all and the money and everything else to get this pipe back because an injustice has been done to you. And I thought of that. I was just thinking of dollar signs and the big hassle and everything in my head. That's the way I kind of think, rather than, is that something, am I thinking right with regards to how I should be thinking? And so it's kind of, it's just tough when injustices have been done for me to get my head straightened out, and Karen does a lot better job than I do.
Well, it is difficult. That's why we all respond to this language. If it were easy, we'd think, yeah, Jesus, preach it. We agree with you. That's the way it ought to be. But it is very difficult. But again, I keep wanting to bring it back to the issue of the Pharisees having a certain picture of what it means to be pleasing to God. And Jesus is trying to step back and say, if you look at the big picture, it's a very striking and demanding picture of what God is looking for in human life. And we're talking about loving your neighbor as yourself, actually worked out in real life situations where wrongs have been done to you. And yet you are not exempt at that spot from the command to love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, if you look at the command, it's specifically in a context where it says, don't take vengeance, don't hold a grudge, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. The context of the command is assuming that we're talking about a situation where somebody has done wrong, and now how are you going to respond to it? Yeah, so to me it comes back to, am I willing, unlike the Pharisees, to see the truth of what it is that God is calling us to and face the music. All of us have to face the music with that stuff. Is that sense that I want my pound of flesh in this scenario. Maybe not all of us feel that, but a lot of us do. And it is something Jesus is asking us to take him seriously there. But at the same time, he's not saying, unless you perfectly accomplish this in your life, God won't have anything to do with you. But if you're like the Pharisees and saying, hey, God, I did everything you wanted, when God wanted major remodeling and all you did is dust in a few corners, then God is not happy with that. What God is looking for is for us to take him seriously, to say, yeah, you're right. That's what it ought to be. I want to try to go that way. That is a hard way to go, and I need your mercy because I am not getting there the way I would like to. So yeah, I mean, that struggle seems to me to be what it is about. But it's not just about that. It is partly recognizing how I fall short, but again, it is partly that picture of, so pick yourself up, let's keep going in that direction. That's where we're called. Seriously, as I hear your story, I mean, the important thing for you is to not hide from the implications of it. Just be willing to look at that. Yeah, that's right. These people who have done these wrong things have not exempted themselves from the requirement on me to love my neighbor as myself. I still have that obligation. Now, what do I do? I don't know. That's a hard question, but I have that. Yeah, I was thinking you might want to volunteer to build a fence for him. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, you're saying that it's the attitude of your heart. It's not a new set of rules. Right. I totally agree with that, but I think sometimes when you think about the attitude of our hearts, we tend to think of how we feel.
Yes.
About things.
Right.
And I just have an example. I'm not going to go into details, but a few months ago, someone did something, said something that caused a great deal of hurt to me and was just a major issue. And I have had a really hard time treating her in a loving way. And I don't see her often, but when I do, I have just asked the Lord to give me that forgiving heart, but I still don't feel necessarily warm and fuzzy toward her.
Right.
And I forgive her for what she's done, but I still have that hurt.
Right.
So I think we have to be careful to not judge ourselves too harshly if we're trying to do what God wants us to do. We're trying to be forgiving and loving and yet falling short. God knows our hearts. God knows that we want to do the right thing. We have that desire, but it's really difficult to do it. And I just am so grateful that he's patient with us and that he loves us and is merciful to allow us to work through that and to grow from it. And maybe the next time it'll be a little bit easier.
Yeah. This is always a tricky thing, a very common thing to wrestle with, the relationship between our emotions and our choices and our will and all that sort of thing. I think we can get mistaken about those things. Like somebody does something that harms me, there is a way that I can feel better about it. I can actually have better feelings about them by sort of lying to myself, denying reality, say this didn't really happen, or oh, it's no big deal, or something. So basically just stuff it, and now I feel better, so I'm being forgiving. But that feeling better is not really the thing that God is talking about. What we're talking about is a thing of the will. It is that actual recognition, no, this was a bad thing. This was a hurtful thing. And now I'm facing the question, am I willing to acknowledge that God has the right to do good things for this person, that I should seek those good things for this person, even though I feel, and rightly so, the enormity of what happened might be the sort of thing that is going to make you feel really bad for a while. But now the question is, what am I willing to acknowledge as the truth in this situation? What am I willing to seek to do in the way I treat that person and the way I think about my own attitudes and all of that?
And I think when Jesus specifically gave examples about giving your coat and all right. those things, he was really saying, take action. Do what you need to do to be forgiving. And maybe taking that action is what helps us kind of get over that, to not just ignore it, but to do something positive toward reconciliation or toward, I don't know, taking action rather than just letting it go.
Well, yeah. No, I see what you're saying. I hadn't thought about it quite in those terms, but that would probably be true. I don't know if turning my other cheek to get hit again is necessarily going to help me feel better about things in that way, but maybe it will. I don't know, especially if I'm a masochist or something, I guess. But okay. Well, my comments are deteriorating here, so let's end.